Chapter 12. 6. Does the reader suppose that that was the end of it? Does he suppose those diffident fishers we satisfied? Let the evidence show. The fishers were quiet just 2 years. Then they came swarming up out of the fertile swamps of Florida with their same old documents, and besieged Congress once more. Congress capitulated on the 1st of June, 1860, and instructed Mr. Floyd to overhaul those papers again and pay that bill. A Treasury clerk was ordered to go through those papers and report to Mr. Floyd what amount was still due the emaciated fishers. This clerk, I can produce him whenever he is wanted, discovered what was apparently a glaring and recent forgery in the paper, whereby a witness's testimony as to the price of corn in Florida in 1813 was made to name double the amount which that witness had originally specified as the price. The clerk not only called his superior's attention to this thing, but in making up his brief of the case called particular attention to it in writing. That part of the brief never got before Congress, nor has Congress ever yet had a hint of forgery existing among the Fisher papers. Nevertheless, on the basis of the double prices, and totally ignoring the clerk's assertion that the figures were manifestly and unquestionably a recent forgery, Mr. Floyd remarks in his new report that the testimony, particularly in regard to the corn crops, demands a much higher allowance than any heretofore made by the auditor or myself. So he estimates the crop at 60 bushels to the acre, double what Florida acres produce, and then virtuously allows pay for only half the crop, but allows $2.50 a bushel for that half, when there are rusty old books and documents in the Congressional Library to show just what the Fisher testimony showed before the forgery, viz., that in the fall of 1813 corn was only worth from $1.25 to $1.50 a bushel. Having accomplished this, what does Mr. Floyd do next? Mr. Floyd, with an earnest desire to execute truly the legislative will, as he piously remarks, goes to work and makes out an entirely new bill of Fisher damages, and in this new bill he placidly ignores the Indians altogether, puts no particle of the destruction of the Fisher property upon them, but, even repenting him of charging them with burning the cabins, and drinking the whiskey and breaking the crockery, lays the entire damage at the door of the imbecile United States troops down to the very last item. And not only that, but uses the forgery to double the loss of corn at Assets Creek, and uses it again to absolutely treble the loss of corn on the Alabama River. This new and ably conceived and executed bill of Mr. Floyd's figures up as follows. I copy again from the printed United States Senate document, the United States in account with the legal representatives of George Fisher, deceased. Dole, CC 1813. To 550 head of cattle, at $10, 5,500.00 to 86 head of drove hogs, $1,204.00 to 350 head of stock hogs, $1,750.00 to 100 acres of corn on Bassett's Creek, $6,000.00 to 8 barrels of whiskey, $350.00 to 2 barrels of brandy, $280.00 to 1 barrel of rum, $70.00 to dry goods and merchandise in store, $1,100.00 to 35 acres of wheat, $350.00 to 2,000 hides, $4,000.00 to furs and hats in store, $600.00 to crockery ware in store, $100.00 to smiths and carpenters' tools, $250.00 to houses burned and destroyed, $600.00 to 4 dozen bottles of wine, $48.00 1814. to 120 acres of corn on Alabama River, 9,500.00 the crops of peas, fodder, etc. $3,250.00 total. $34,952.00 to interest on $22.202 from July 1813 to November 1860, 47 years and 4 months. $63,053.68 to interest on $12,750 from September 1814 to November 1860, 46 years and 2 months. $35,317.50 total. $133,323.18 He puts everything in this time. He does not even allow that the Indians destroyed the crockery or drank the 4 dozen bottles of currant wine. When it came to supernatural comprehensiveness in Obling, John B. Floyd was without his equal in his own or any other generation. Subtracting from the above total the $67,000 already paid to George Fisher's implacable heirs, Mr. Floyd announced that the government was still indebted to them in the sum of $66,519.85, which, Mr. Floyd complacently remarks, will be paid, accordingly, to the administrator of the estate of George Fisher, deceased, or to his attorney in fact. But, sadly enough for the destitute orphans, a new president came in just at this time. Buchanan and Floyd went out, and they never got their money. The first thing Congress did in 1861 was to rescind the resolution of June 1, 1860, under which Mr. Floyd had been suffering. Then Floyd, and doubtless the heirs of George Fisher likewise, had to give up financial business for a while, and go into the Confederate Army, and serve their country. Were the heirs of George Fisher killed? No. They are back now at this very time, July, 1870, beseeching Congress through that blushing and diffident creature, Garrett Davis, to commence making payments again on their interminable and insatiable bill of damages for corn and whiskey destroyed by a gang of irresponsible Indians, so long ago that even government red tape has failed to keep consistent and intelligent track of it. Now the above are facts. They are history. Anyone who doubts it can send to the Senate Document Department of the Capitol for H.R. X. Doc. Number 21, 36th Congress, 2D Session, and 4S. X. Doc. Number 106, 41st Congress, 2D Session, and satisfy himself. The whole case is set forth in the first volume of the Court of Claims Reports. It is my belief that as long as the continent of America holds together, the heirs of George Fisher, deceased, will still make pilgrimages to Washington from the swamps of Florida to plead for just a little more cash on their bill of damages. Even when they received the last of that $67,000, they said it was only 1/4 what the government owed them on that fruitful corn field, and as long as they choose to come they will find Garrett Davises to drag their vampire schemes before Congress. This is not the only hereditary fraud, if fraud it is, which I have before repeatedly remarked is not proven, that is being quietly handed down from generation to generation of fathers and sons, through the persecuted treasury of the United States. Disgraceful persecution of a boy in San Francisco. The other day, a well-dressed boy, on his way to Sunday school, was arrested and thrown into the city prison for stoning Chinamen. What a commentary is this upon human justice! What sad prominence it gives to our human disposition to tyrannize over the weak! San Francisco has little right to take credit to herself for her treatment of this poor boy. What had the child's education been? How should he suppose it was wrong to stone a Chinaman? Before we side against him, along with outraged San Francisco, let us give him a chance, let us hear the testimony for the defense. He was a well-dressed boy and a Sunday school scholar, and therefore the chances are that his parents were intelligent, well-to-do people with just enough natural villainy in their composition to make them yearn after the daily papers and enjoy them. And so this boy had opportunities to learn all through the week how to do right, as well as on Sunday. It was in this way that he found out that the great Commonwealth of California imposes an unlawful mining tax upon John the Foreigner, and allows Patrick the Foreigner to dig gold for nothing, probably because the degraded Mongol is at no expense for whiskey, and the refined silk cannot exist without it. It was in this way that he found out that a respectable number of the tax gatherers, it would be unkind to say all of them, collect the tax twice instead of once, and that, inasmuch as they do it solely to discourage Chinese immigration into the mines, it is a thing that is much applauded, and likewise regarded as being singularly facetious. It was in this way that he found out that, when a white man robs a sluice box, by the term white man is meant Spaniards, Mexicans, Portuguese, Irish, Hondurans, Peruvians, Chileans, etc., etc., they make him leave the camp, and when a Chinaman does that thing, they hang him. It was in this way that he found out that in many districts of the vast Pacific coast, so strong is the wild, free love of justice in the hearts of the people, that whenever any secret and mysterious crime is committed, they say, "Let justice be done, though the heavens fall," and go straightway and swing a Chinaman. It was in this way that he found out that, by studying one half of each day's OSIL items, it would appear that the police of San Francisco were either asleep or dead, and by studying the other half it would seem that the reporters were gone mad with admiration of the energy, the virtue, the high effectiveness, and the daredevil intrepidity of that very police, making exultant mention of how the Argus side officer so-and-so captured a wretched knave of a Chinaman who was stealing chickens, and brought him gloriously to the city prison, and how the gallant officer such and such a one quietly kept an eye on the movements of an suspecting, Amandite son of Confucius. Your reporter is nothing if not facetious, following him around with that far-off look. A vacancy and unconsciousness always so finely affected by that inscrutable being, the $40 policeman, during a waking interval, uncaptured him at last in the very act of placing his hands in a suspicious manner upon a paper of tax, left by the owner in an exposed situation. And how one officer performed this prodigious thing, and another officer that, and another the other, and pretty much every one of these performances, having for a dazzling central incident a Chinaman guilty of a shilling's worth of crime, an unfortunate, whose misdemeanor must be hurrahed into something enormous in order to keep the public from noticing how many really important rascals went uncaptured in the meantime, and how overrated those glorified policemen actually are. It was in this way that the boy found out that the legislature, being aware that the Constitution has made America an asylum for the poor and the oppressed of all nations, and that, therefore, the poor and oppressed who fly to our shelter must not be charged a disabling admission fee, made a law that every Chinaman, upon landing, must be vaccinated upon the wharf, and pay to the state's appointed officer $10 for the service, when there are plenty of doctors in San Francisco who would be glad enough to do it for him for 50 cents. It was in this way that the boy found out that a Chinaman had no rights that any man was bound to respect, that he had no sorrows that any man was bound to pity, that neither his life nor his liberty was worth the purchase of a penny when a white man needed a scapegoat, that nobody loved Chinamen, nobody befriended them, nobody spared them suffering when it was convenient to inflict it. Everybody, individuals, communities, the majesty of the state itself, joined in hating, abusing, and persecuting these humble strangers. And, therefore, what could have been more natural than for this sunny-hearted boy, tripping along to Sunday school, with his mind teeming with freshly learned incentives to high and virtuous action, to say to himself, Ah, there goes a Chinaman. God will not love me if I do not stone him. And for this, he was arrested and put in the city jail. Everything conspired to teach him that it was a high and holy thing to stone a Chinaman, and yet he no sooner attempts to do his duty than he is punished for it. He, poor chap, who has been aware all his life that one of the principal recreations of the police, out toward the gold refinery, is to look on with tranquil enjoyment, while the butchers of Brannan Street set their dogs on unoffending Chinamen, and make them flee for their lives.
I have many such memories in my mind, but I'm thinking just at present of one particular one, where the Brannan Street butchers set their dogs on a Chinaman who was quietly passing with a basket of clothes on his head. And while the dogs mutilated his flesh, a butcher increased the hilarity of the occasion by knocking some of the Chinaman's teeth down his throat with half a brick. This incident sticks in my memory with a more malevolent tenacity, perhaps, on account of the fact that I was in the employ of a San Francisco journal at the time, and was not allowed to publish it, because it might offend some of the peculiar element that subscribed for the paper.
Keeping in mind the tuition in the humanities which the entire Pacific Coast gives its youth, there is a very sublimity of incongruity in the virtuous flourish with which the good city fathers of San Francisco proclaim, as they have lately done, that the police are positively ordered to arrest all boys, of every description and wherever found, who engage in assaulting Chinamen. Still, let us be truly glad they have made the order, notwithstanding its inconsistency, and let us rest perfectly confident the police are glad too. Because there is no personal peril in arresting boys, provided they be of the small kind, and the reporters will have to laud their performances just as loyally as ever, or go without items. The new form for local items in San Francisco will now be : the ever-vigilant and efficient officer so-and-so succeeded, yesterday afternoon, in arresting Master Tommy Jones, after a determined resistance, etc., etc., followed by the customary statistics and final hurrah, with its unconscious sarcasm : we are happy in being able to state that this is the 47th boy arrested by this gallant officer since the new ordinance went into effect. The most extraordinary activity prevails in the police department. Nothing like it has been seen since we can remember. The judge's spirited woman, I was sitting here, said the judge, in this old pulpit, holding court, and we were trying a big, wicked-looking Spanish desperado for killing the husband of a bright, pretty Mexican woman. It was a lazy summer day, and an awfully long one, and the witnesses were tedious. None of us took any interest in the trial except that nervous, uneasy devil of a Mexican woman, because you know how they love, and how they hate, and this one had loved her husband with all her might, and now as he had boiled it all down into hate, and stood here spitting it at that Spaniard with her eyes, and I tell you she would stir me up too, with a little of her summer lightning, occasionally. Well, I had my coat off and my heels up, lolling and sweating, and smoking one of those cabbage cigars the San Francisco people used to think were good enough for us in those times. And the lawyers they all had their coats off, and were smoking and whittling, and the witnesses the same, and so was the prisoner. Well, the fact is, there weren't any interest in a murder trial then, because the fellow was always brought in not guilty, apostrophe the jury expecting him to do as much for them sometime. And, although the evidence was straight and square against this Spaniard, we knew we could not convict him without seeming to be rather high-handed, and sort of reflecting on every gentleman in the community. For there weren't any carriages and liveries then, and so the only style there was to keep your private graveyard. But that woman seemed to have her heart set on hanging that Spaniard, and you'd ought to have seen how she would glare on him a minute, and then look up at me in her pleading way, and then turn, and for the next 5 minutes search the jury's faces, and by drop her face in her hands for just a little while, as if she was most ready to give up. But out she'd come again directly, and be as live,
and anxious as ever. But when the jury announced the verdict not guilty and I told the prisoner he was acquitted and free to go, that woman rose up till she appeared to be as tall and grand as a 74 gunship, and says she, "Judge, do I understand you to say that this man is not guilty that murdered my husband without any cause before my own eyes and my little children's, and that all has been done to him that ever justice and the law can do?" The same, says I. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.